Oh, that's interesting. That equates good self-esteem when you...
That's where you get yourself... Yeah, that's how you maintain your self-esteem.
But when you're... That's when you're putting someone else down?
When you put in other people down, maintain self-esteem.
That's interesting. That's not what I thought self-esteem was about. I didn't realize it was in the context of comparison or putting someone down.
Well, people will say that authentic self-esteem is a trait. It's robust. It's stable. But it's not. It fluctuates. Mm-hmm. But like there'll be that overarching, you know, the overarching latent factor of self-esteem is pretty stable, but there are day-to-day hits on your self-esteem. There are minute-to-minute hits on your self-esteem. And this is dealt, processed with very quickly for the most part, but sometimes it's processed a little bit in a more sinister way. Now, there are other ways you can repair your self-esteem and maintain your health, self-esteem. We're just focusing on this topic. So I don't want everybody to think that this is the only way that this is done. But the kids in our study, the adolescent girls in our studies who had the better self-esteem, put down their source of threat.
Okay. And so the study, you said it was 1,100?
No, so this is another study of 700 adolescents that we've been following from the time they were 10 until they're now 26.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so what are the qualities? I mean, so we're talking about self-esteem, but what are the other qualities that allow someone to thrive, to, if there is such a thing as healthy competition, I think there is, because sports is a good example. What are the qualities that you see that are necessary for a person, and maybe especially females, but anybody, to have a healthy sense of self, to have, you know, a sense of worth,
no, to I thrive, understand what you're
asking. To mm-hmm. thrive in the world without necessarily having to, you know, go to battle?
So there are two types of competitiveness, and we haven't made that distinction. So there's the personal development competitiveness, and there's the hyper-competitiveness. So I've been focusing on hyper-competitiveness, where zero-sum game, if I win, you lose, if you win, I lose, that sort of thing. But there's also personal development competitiveness, and there are people in the world who have this type of personality, where the competition makes them feel like they need to, it, in a sense, it influences them in the way, in a positive way. So they want to be better than they were before, but they're competing with themselves. So instead of I have to beat everybody to feel good about myself, I just need to be better than what I was before. So if I notice that you're really good at X, whatever X is, and it's something that I value, instead of becoming jealous and putting you down or internalizing that jealousy, I use that to motivate myself to become even better at X. And those people exist too. And that also maintains your self-esteem. In our studies, what we find is that it's more likely they're going to be hyper-competitive than that personal development competitiveness. But this is where I think, and this is the work that I do in sport a lot, is trying to get individuals to be more on that personal development competitiveness than the hyper-competitiveness. So instead of focusing on how Sarah is a better soccer player than you, focus on what I have to do to become a better soccer player. And then I may then overtake Sarah on that starting position.
Do you find that do you have a goal or an interest in promoting more of that personal competition and development? Or are you just simply, you know, doing the research and observing and, you know, sharing those results? Or is part of your work also to promote a specific kind of competition, whether it's the hyper or the personal development part of it?
That's my life's work, really. So like when I do my outreach work, so I do a lot of work in sport in Canada. And I work with elite athletes across different sectors, sports sectors. I work with coaches. And I always emphasize this difference between hyper-competitiveness and personal development competitiveness. And I talk about, in a sense, it's like using cognitive behavioral therapy to get towards this personal development. So, you know, and it takes a lot of work because
I would think so.
You know, I mean, I would say, you know, there's another component I just need to say. Competitiveness and how it manifests also has to do with what you value. So I don't know, Tiffany, did you ever play soccer? Were you ever a soccer player?
No, I was a basketball player, though, in terms of team sports.
So if we were doing penalty shot practices, you know, I decided to go out and kick the ball around. That domain really matters to me. Being a good soccer player is a domain that's important to me, but it won't be important to you because it's not your sport. So if you miss the net 80% of the time, you're not going to be bothered by it. It's not going to elicit this reaction. You're not going to feel competitive with me because you're going to be like, I'm going to give it to her. This is something she's good at, right? I don't care. Same with if we were doing basketball. But if we were both soccer players and we were out there, then we would get competitive. So I just wanted to make that distinction that so the self-esteem that's like folded into the comparison, social comparisons that leads to competitiveness, that sort of thing also has to do with what you value. So if you value being a beautiful woman, if you value being a smart woman, if you value being a good mother, that those are the domains you're competing in. You're not going to compete in domains that you don't care about, right? Like it just like, let them have it. I don't care, right? So anyhow, so that said, exactly, I'm trying to get athletes to think differently about this and get coaches to think differently because they'll be more resilient and there'll be less burnout. There'll be fewer mental health issues, that sort of thing. So yeah, this is something I'm quite passionate about.
That's exciting. I'm glad to know that, you know, that you're able to then take your work and extrapolate it out into the world and have an influence. You know, that is a really cool passion. And is it something, I know you said it takes a lot of work, but is it something that people understand? Like, are they able to grab onto?
They get it right away. They get it right away because even, you know, back to what we value and how that affects our, like the manifestation of that comparison, people get that right away. So again, like if you don't care about soccer, you're not going to care about a competition we're going to get involved in. And so, but if you care a lot about it, it's going to be hard to rein in that hyper-competitiveness side, especially when, let's say we're in a competition and only one of us is going to go through and represent Canada or the United States. So how do I manage my emotions when the resources are so scarce and it means so much to me.
Right. And do you do any of this outreach with the younger people?
Yeah, I do it with young athletes.
Athletes.
Yeah. So I primarily this stuff I do with athletes.
Okay.
But it's really interesting because like athletes in a sense are like, when you think about like all traits reside along a continuum. So, you know, the bell curve, you can kind of think about there's going to be some that have it quite exaggerated and others that barely have it. So I'm at that end of that far end of the curve on competitiveness. Like these individuals are very competitive and they wear their heart on their sleeve. So in a way it's really raw and it's easy to see. And so I think it makes me a good scientist too.
Right. That makes sense. Yes. Well, and I'm curious, when it comes to the bullying aspect, just going back to where we started with young people, and especially I think it's girls that you focused on, if I understand, what is it that needs to be a part of an environment to help quell some of the bullying? I mean, I know that's a very individual sort of experience, a personal experience, but I imagine the environment contributes to bullying.
100%.
Like schools or yes. Wherever. And I'm just, I don't know. We all know about bullying. This has become such a hot topic and mm-hmm. we understand because of, you know, our kids and it's a real thing. You know, we don't have to, most of us don't have to go out and do any research. We know it happens. We see it. But I'm curious from your standpoint, how do the environments that kids are in contribute to bullying and what can be done to start to minimize this or at least address mm-hmm. it more head on?
One of the things that I think we've done a really poor job at and why our reductions of bullying rates are so poor is that we focused on a subset of kids who bully others that don't represent the typical bully. So we've kind of, in a sense, we hold the stereotype of who bullies others, like Nelson from The Simpsons. But most kids who bully others wield power. So, and some programs, some anti-bullying programs are now appreciating this and are working in this power structure into their prevention and intervention efforts. That said, it's interesting because the kids who are most impervious to our best attempts at reducing bullying are the high status bullies. And why would they give up their source of power, right? I mean, it feels good to be at the top of that hierarchy. There's a lot of privilege that comes with it. So we need to rethink this, and we need to be thinking about this power structure and the power dynamics a lot more. Bullying is a systematic abuse of power. One of the things I'd like to see us do earlier in our anti-bullying programs is to talk about power and the corrupting influence of power and how to be good when you hold power. So you could think about, you can have implicit power that is achieved by having assets and competencies that the peer group values. I always talk about Barack Obama to me is a great example of implicit power. You can also have explicit power, which is achieved by eliciting fear and submission. So being an autocratic leader and that sort of thing. And so I always think about Donald Trump as being a great example of explicit power. And then those who bully others are kind of like this melange of implicit and explicit power. So they have assets and competencies that the peer group values that tend to be good looking, athletic, those sorts of things, come from wealthier families. But then they also have that autocratic side where they're eliciting fear and compliance and submission. And so if we had kids understand that with power comes enormous responsibility, but we don't ever have those conversations about power with kids. And so what we see is that in our studies, and that's been replicated, we found that kids who were bullied became bullies over time. Because if you can't beat them, you might as well join them. It feels better to bully others than to be bullied. That's a problem, right? Mm-hmm. But it makes sense because what they see around them are examples of using aggressive means in a way that works. So it'll be interesting to see, like, a good example, again, the Super Bowl yesterday with Travis Kelce going after his coach in such a visible way and problematic way. You know, he kind of represents that popular kid in the high school, good looking, dating the most popular girl in the school. They have everything. Everybody's interested in them. And then he misbehaved in a really visible way. And what are the implications of that? I suspect there aren't going to be many. And so what message does that then send back to kids? That you can bully with impunity, you can misbehave, and there'll be no sanctions if you hold certain characteristics. So we have a lot of work to do.
Yes. And I'm wondering in terms of, I know that you're writing a book, or you're going to be releasing a book soon about a lot of these ideas and also this, you know, offering solutions. When you think about parents or teachers or coaches, mm-hmm. Or just, you know, community members, thinking of, you know, people in groups, from the adult perspective, what words of wisdom or insights or guidance would you want people to consider and to, you know, to think about applying in their lives on whatever level that is in terms of this topic of competition and power and bullying?
It comes back to that honest discussion. I mean, it's hard to repair something that you're not willing to acknowledge. So one of the things that I've noticed in my career, and I've done also frontline work, so it's not just research, you know, I also have an applied part to this, is that a lot of times when parents now are brought to their attention that their kid is bullying others, they deny that that's even plausible. Like right away, it's like, and they, in a sense, engage in bullying behavior. There's no way my sweet little Emily could ever do that, which is such because Emily is not a saint at home. Like they know who this kid is and they know that their daughter's temperament. So what I would love for us to recognize and for parents to start accepting is that aggression is part of the human condition, that kids are just learning about this, you know, learning how to manage their emotions, learning how to manage their jealousy, their social comparisons, how to wield their power appropriately. And so if we shut down the conversation and we support their viewpoint, which is erroneous, then we're not doing any favors for our kid or for society. So we have to have these tough conversations. We have to be open-minded. And it doesn't reflect poorly on you if your kid has bullied somebody else. What it reflects is human development. And so instead of being defensive, you know, be open-minded, listen to what the educators are telling you, and work with your child to be better. But if you right away take their side and say, this is not plausible, then we're going to get nowhere. We're not going to be able to reduce this. And we already have a hard time reducing bullying.
Have you ever been aware of like character development programs in schools and how that influences or reduces bullying? Is that something that exists that you're aware of?
So some of the better programs deal with moral disengagement. And moral disengagement is a cognitive mechanism that we all use to make our egregious acts more palatable. So if I do something really crummy, because I don't think I'm a bad person, I need to repair that. And I use a variety of different strategies, cognitive strategies, but they all fall under this umbrella called moral disengagement. I may say that, well, you were being provocative, so you had it coming to you. I may diffuse my responsibility and say, well, I was just watching. I wasn't really participating. I might make an advantageous comparison where I say, I just called you a name. It's not like I shoved you in the locker. All of these things to repair it. I'll use euphemistic labels saying like, I was just teasing you. I wasn't bullying you. So I kind of make myself feel right with what I've done. So we all do this. And again, back to self-esteem, like you maintain your self-esteem by, in a sense, you're gaslighting yourself the whole time. Like, I'm a good person. They had it coming to them, that sort of thing. So programs that address moral disengagement, because moral disengagement is attached to bullying, tend to have reductions in bullying behavior. So getting kids to be morally responsible and present and to not wiggle their way out of it. Because if you wiggle your way out of it by making all these excuses, you haven't done the work to not do it again.
Okay. Yeah, that does require work. You're right.
It does.
I think to start at a young age, you know, learning the tools and the process or processes to do that work is critical, because when you become an adult, if you haven't done any of that work, whew, it's a lot harder.
And you're blaming everybody else then.
And
right.
And there are, I would think the stakes would be higher possibly in certain circumstances.
Exactly.
So it does pay to address things at a younger age, even though it's uncomfortable. It's awkward to have these kinds of conversations. And like you said, I think for parents, it can be very difficult to be in that vulnerable place, you know, where your child may be the cause of, you know, some harm or pain. And it's like you said, I think it's to frame it in the light of, this is just part of development. So let's not, you don't have to, you know, sacrifice yourself in terms of, you know, thinking that my child is perfect and can never do wrong. And, you know, to ignore that this is just part of life, but let's address what needs to be addressed now. And hopefully it just makes life easier for everybody.
I'll give you an example. So I remember my daughter, Molly, telling me about how in grade 6, this kid had done her wrong, right? So this girl had did X, Y, and Z, and hearing it, you can't help but become emotionally involved right away. I had a visceral reaction to what I was hearing. But I also do this for a living. So I also said to her, okay, so thanks for sharing. How is she going to tell her mother the story? Like, what is her story going to be? How is she going to describe it? And so then when Molly explained how she thought the person would explain what had happened, I got a more fulsome idea of what had happened. And they were both inappropriate. So instead of like me taking it at face value that this kid had done her wrong and this kid needed to be punished, you know, I recognize that interactions are just that, interactions that have more than one person. And so their viewpoint needs to be considered. And then in doing so, you could get closer to truth and closer to fixing this.
That seems so useful and helpful. Thank you. Yes. Because it's true. Emotionally, you just become protective and
defensive,
and that's natural. You want to protect your child. So I think the ultimate goal is for everyone to, you know, to grow and to learn. And this is, you have to get to truth or as much of the truth as you can in order to evolve.
Yeah.
It seems. So everybody has everyone has a role. Young people.
We all do. Adults. Exactly. It's the reframing. Like the reframing is really important, especially for parents. We act as prefrontal cortex for our kids. We're their surrogate prefrontal cortex. And they don't have the same ability to interpret the information. They don't have the same background, right? Like they're just emerging as children, growing into adolescents, growing into adults. So we don't expect them to get it all right. But what we can do is we can reframe things so that they're getting closer to truth.
Yes. That seems like a good plan to me. Before we wrap up, I thought I would ask, do you have any, I don't know, any words of wisdom or insights or any final thoughts you wanted to share with people listening, or I'm sure from a variety of backgrounds and circumstances, but in the context of competition and the idea that, you know, competition in and of itself isn't bad, but the idea that we all want to thrive, and thinking of kids and everybody wants to thrive and be happy. And I'd like to think people want to feel good about their lives and how they're contributing to the world. And in terms of trying to, I guess, in my mind, promote kind of a higher level of of behavior, as opposed to just thinking that it's about all or nothing or scarcity. Like, what can people think about, or what can they take away in your final thoughts or words in terms of just, we all hopefully can be happy and thrive and, you know, work through our challenges from a place of hopefully emotional maturity or clarity and insight.
We're going to make social comparisons. We all make social comparisons. We want to see how we measure up. I mean, that's part of the human condition as well. And so I think that when we make the social comparison and we start feeling yucky about it, because when the social comparison doesn't favor us, then I think we need to take a step back and pause and not react immediately. And think, can I use this to benefit me in a more positive way? Can I get this to, can I use this to motivate myself to work harder or to be more creative or whatever it's going to be, right? Instead of doing the lazy route. And the lazy route to me is attacking the source of jealousy, the source that's making you feel icky. And then I think that this comes full circle to your topic of shame. I mean, it does make you feel shame when you feel like you're not measuring up and you don't matter, or you're not achieving as much. And so that has to, we can repair that. We can do that cognitive reframing where, again, we use it to our advantage instead of repair it in a nefarious way. That makes sense.
Thank you so much. And I want to ask you a question, which I ask all my guests at the end. Which TV show would you recommend? It doesn't have to be your favorite, but which would you recommend, new or old show, and why?
So it's interesting. I do a little bit of research on autism. About 30% of my research is autism. And I really like Love on the Spectrum. But there's some controversy about it, because some people have argued that, well, you know, in a sense, we're voyeurs of individuals who have autism spectrum disorder. We're infantilizing them and the like. And yet the people who are in those shows themselves say, no, that's not at all how we feel. You know, this is something we participated in that we wanted to do, and that has brought us pleasure. And we appreciate the efforts that were put in to making this a positive experience. So that said, I love Love on the Spectrum.
Okay, I've heard of it. Yeah, you know, I haven't watched it.
There's an American version. It originated in Australia, and now there's two seasons of the American version, and it's fantastic.
Okay, and it's insightful. It sounds like into
Yes, I really appreciate it.
That's cool. Okay, wonderful. I will add that to the list.
So you're lovely. I really enjoyed this. You're so calm in your presentation style, and so I appreciated that a lot. Thank you.
Oh, good. Well, thank you. I really appreciate you taking the time to share your insights, talk about your research. I know you've talked about this a lot, but I appreciate you framing it, you know, within the topic of shame and competition. So thank you. It's been insightful and even inspiring for me, especially as you talked about how you're applying this in other ways, you know, outside of your research and the work you're doing with your coaching. That's wonderful to hear. And it's just, it's helpful to hear someone talk about, you know, taking a topic that they've studied and then applying it out in the real world and trying to make a difference. So thank you for that work you're doing.
And reverse engineering it, I think, is why my studies have replicated, because, you know, there's a replication issue, is because I see it and I see it over and over again. And then I test out the phenomenon in the lab.
That's cool. Yes, that I imagine that is so useful. And that that means that you really do care about this work. I know you called it your passion.
Yeah, I love it. I love my job.
That comes through. That really comes through. Well, thank you again for being here, for taking the time and giving your energy and for all the work you're doing. And we'll look out for your book. You said it's coming out later this year.
Yeah, I'll keep you posted.